ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Good morning. Welcome to AM. It's Wednesday, the 7th of January. I'm David Lipson in Canberra, coming to you from Ngunnawal country and acknowledging other custodians. There are growing expectations this morning that the Prime Minister will backflip on opposing a federal royal commission into the Bondi terror attack and announce an inquiry as soon as this week. After weeks of ardent resistance, Anthony Albanese yesterday refused to rule out a royal commission, saying he's meeting with people on a daily basis about what further responses are needed. Today, a joint statement from 32 respected intelligence and security experts, including former Governor-General David Hurley, called for the establishment of a royal commission with the scope to address government-level decision-making. Samantha Dick has the latest from Parliament House.
Following weeks of pressure, Prime Minister Anthony Albanese has moved from strongly opposing a federal royal commission into the Bondi terror attack to now softening his language.
We are engaged with the community as well as with the New South Wales government to make sure that we get done everything that is required.
Mr. Albanese has previously pledged cooperation with the New South Wales Royal Commission into the mass shooting, but has so far resisted the growing push for a federal one, arguing a national version would take too long, double up with existing work, and sow division in the community. Dr. Scott Prasser, an independent researcher and former coalition government policy advisor, says he doesn't buy those arguments.
Every royal commission is a bespoke body. Each one is different. So it's the way you set up the Royal Commission that gives you the flexibility to make it effective.
Dr. Prasser says a Commonwealth Royal Commission would have a greater scope than the New South Wales investigation, as it would have more access to national security agencies and more power to compel Commonwealth officials to answer questions.
The state Royal Commission can't make the Commonwealth give it information. It can't interrogate Commonwealth officers before it. Or if it does, it'll be very limited in what they can do.
But some Australians personally involved in royal commissions warn they don't always deliver lasting change. Injured veteran Ian Lindgren was elated when a royal commission was announced into defence and veteran suicide after years of campaigning.
It was the pivotal thing which we saw would expose and explain what everybody was feeling from the traumatic way that they were treated.
But while Mr. Lindgren says the quality of the investigation was first class, 15 months on, he holds serious doubts over whether the inquiry's recommendations will ever be properly implemented.
I don't believe that the recommendations from the Royal Commission will be implemented in the way that the commissioners made the recommendations at all.
Knowing what he does now, Mr. Lindgren says he backs a royal commission into the Bondi massacre, but says the real catalyst for change will be further down the road.
You want to be able to have some organisation take over and have that independent entity take those recommendations forward and hold the Commonwealth and the states, in this case, to account.
Anthony Albanese says he's prioritising a review examining Australia's security and intelligence agencies, as well as strengthening hate speech and gun laws. The government will begin consultation on draft legislation in coming days and is expected to recall Parliament when the reforms are ready.
Samantha Dick and Claire Armstrong reporting. The UK and France have announced they will send forces to Ukraine in the event of a peace deal after the Coalition of the Willing reached a new agreement on security guarantees in Paris. Europe correspondent Bridget Rollison is in London. Bridget, what happened in this meeting?
Well, David, the aim of this meeting was to really work out security arrangements for Ukraine if a peace deal is reached, and then what happens once there is a ceasefire. So a key part of this was also to make sure that the US is a part of any force to protect Ukraine's borders if the fighting does stop. So the US's envoys, Steve Witkoff, and also President Donald Trump's son-in-law, Jared Kushner, were at this meeting in Paris for the US, where they joined 30 of Ukraine's allies. What we've heard so far is that an agreement on security guarantees have been reached. The UK and France have signed a declaration of intent to send armed forces to Ukraine, and they would do that on the day after a ceasefire is announced to help with long-term security. And we also know that the US would support this European-led multinational force to deter and stop any future attacks by Russia. And the French President Emmanuel Macron said that that would happen from the land and the air and the sea. So we know there's going to be this multinational force of some kind somewhere, but we don't particularly know the exact details on that. We also heard that the US would lead efforts to monitor a ceasefire in Ukraine, presumably with things like drones and satellites. So it does sound like there is progress, but I don't think we can really judge this meeting as success or a failure yet, because all these leaders have been really talking this up, including the US envoy, Steve Witkoff.
We also think, critically, that we are very, very close to finishing up as robust a prosperity agreement as any country has ever seen coming out of conflicts like this. It will aspirationally mean large, large possibilities for the Ukrainian people. And we think we've made a lot of progress.
So that was US envoy Steve Witkoff. And this meeting in Paris was all about getting Ukraine, Europe and the US on the same page to take a position to Russia in future negotiations to reach a peace deal. It was significant that the Americans were there because it does show that they are largely on board with this. But there is still a major sticking point, and that's the issue of territory. So Moscow wants Ukraine to give up land that it still controls in the Donbass region in Ukraine's east. And it's unlikely to back down from those demands. But, you know, we've heard all these talks and all these meetings about a ceasefire, but there's actually no indication from Russia that it's even interested in one. And it's showed no signs that it's ready to stop fighting.
And Bridget, Donald Trump's ambitions for the US to take control of Greenland was also an issue that came up today.
Yeah, that was a massive elephant in the room today, David. And I think things could have got a bit awkward in this meeting with the US and these coalition of the willing leaders after the US President Donald Trump reiterated his threats that he wanted to take over Greenland at the weekend. So this meeting was planned before the US's military operation in Venezuela, which has really upended the geopolitical landscape and I guess emboldened actions from countries like Russia. But it also means that NATO members, a lot of who are at this coalition of the willing meeting today, have to now grapple with President Donald Trump and this threat, which is feeling more realistic than ever. So the European leaders have been throwing their support behind Denmark. Greenland is a part of the Kingdom of Denmark, which is a part of NATO. And although these European leaders have been careful, I guess, not to criticise Trump directly, but Denmark's Prime Minister has warned that if the US takes over Greenland, which we know is rich in minerals and strategically located in the Arctic, then that would mean the end of the 80-year-old NATO alliance. So other NATO members have said that it's only for Denmark and Greenland to decide on matters concerning Greenland, not the US. So these EU leaders really want to stay on the side of the US, and they really don't want to criticise Trump directly. And I think they were really hoping that this meeting would focus on Ukraine, but this is kind of, this issue of Greenland has kind of overshadowed this meeting. So it really is a fine balance that these European leaders are trying to manage.
That's our Europe correspondent, Bridget Rollison. Well, days after the US military raid that captured and deposed Venezuelan President Nicolas Maduro, questions remain as to whether there will be a peaceful and democratic transition of power in the country. It comes as Venezuela's opposition leader in hiding appeared on US television to thank Donald Trump for his courageous vision. ABC correspondent Ben Knight is in our Washington bureau. Ben, we just heard from President Trump. Did he shed any new light on future leadership in Venezuela?
No, not at all. This was a speech that went for over an hour. It's the first major speech he's given since the Venezuela operation, which, as you say, is 3 days ago now. This was to a group of Republican members of Congress who were having a winter retreat. So Donald Trump, he talked about Venezuela in passing, I suppose. He talked about the success and the pride in the military operation, but he appeared to be more concerned about the looming midterm elections coming later this year and the thought that the Republicans might not be successful and branched into some other favourite territory, such as transgender athletes in women's sports and so on and so forth. So, no, not a lot about the future leadership in Venezuela. And this is one of the things that has a lot of people here asking, what is next? I'm sure around the world asking what is next. There are mixed messages. You know, Donald Trump last night, local time, said, no, I'm running Venezuela. And then you have other members of the administration say, well, clearly, you know, we're not running Venezuela. We're not running the education system. We're not setting the bus prices. But, our economic power, our clout means that we can control the country. But in effect, you know, the Maduro regime, minus Nicolas Maduro, is still in charge. And that is a problem for the United States, I guess, because it's essentially put itself in the same situation it found itself after the capture of Saddam Hussein or the capture of Iraq. And this quandary about what do you do with the government? What do you do with the administration? What do you do with the civil service? Well, the decision at that time was, as I'm sure people remember, called de-Bathification, where essentially any person who was connected with Saddam Hussein's Ba'ath Party was removed or prosecuted and jailed. So that created a couple of problems. One was you had no technocrats that could run the country or run those systems. And the other one was that it created an insurgency from those people who'd been removed. Now, we're not quite at that point yet, but if leaving this regime in charge or putting in a new one, we have no idea what's about to happen.
So what of the opposition then in Venezuela? Its leader, Maria Corina Machado, has pledged to return to her country. What has she said?
So she did an interview with Fox News here in the United States last night, local time. She spoke with Sean Hannity. She said a couple of things. She said that the transition should move forward. She said that if elections in Venezuela are free and fair, that the opposition would win with 90%. Now, that's a long way away. She's not even in the country. She is essentially in hiding and left Venezuela to accept the Nobel Peace Prize. But Donald Trump has said, no, she's not the person who should take over. She has no respect inside the country. So effectively, handing power to the opposition has been ruled out. And then we get back to, okay, does that leave essentially the Maduro regime or members of the Maduro administration in charge? So Maria Corina Machado says the option is that you leave Venezuela under the control of the members of the previous regime, including Maduro's deputy and the new interim president, Delcy Rodriguez. Here's what she had to say.
Delcy Rodriguez, as you know, is one of the main architects of torture, persecution, corruption, narco trafficking. She's the main ally and liaison with Russia, China, Iran. And as you mentioned, and we won an election by a landslide under fraudulent conditions, in free and fair elections, we will win by over 90% of the votes. I have no doubt about it.
So that's Maria Corina Machado speaking there. So she's clearly speaking with the American media and pushing her case for the opposition to take control. But that's not what we're hearing from the White House or Donald Trump.
Ben Knight in Washington there. Over the last decade, almost 8 million Venezuelans have fled the country, unable to cope with the economic crisis and political repression. Around 6,000 are living in Australia and dealing with the shock of the US intervention in their country. Nicole Johnson reports.
I couldn't believe it. I was in shock. I freaked out. I almost had this big anxiety attack.
Leo Rivers is from Venezuela, but has lived in Sydney for the last 12 years. He fled the country as his family grew poorer under President Nicolas Maduro.
Once the government started to take over properties and my family business started to suffer, things started to be very challenging. By the time that I left Venezuela more than 10 years ago, the crisis was starting to get really bad. You couldn't find toilet paper in the supermarket. You couldn't find chicken. You couldn't find anything.
Are you worried, though, that this crisis in Venezuela could make the situation even worse as it goes through whatever type of transition there is?
We have been through so many stages in Venezuela that there is a point that we say we have hit rock bottom. Venezuela has dropped 14 zeros out of the currency just to make it readable.
Do you support the way the United States has carried this out?
Honestly, Venezuela has been raped and bled for the last 27 years by other nations. Russia, China, they own large proportion of the country. They take all our gold. Venezuela has lost its dignity.
Mr. Rivers says the streets of Venezuela are awash with guns, gang violence and crime.
When I tell my friends the things that I used to do to keep my life, basically, because in Venezuela you can get killed for a phone. You have to get a decoy phone, so basically you hide it in your socks or in your underwear, and then you have a decoy, a cheaper phone on your pocket, so then if you get approached, they you handle that cheap phone, because if you don't handle anything, you get killed anyways. I have lost so many friends and relatives. It seems that the life was worth nothing.
You spoke to some family members in Caracas. Did they hear the explosions and the attack to take the president?
When I called them, I actually woke them up and then I told them, like, hey, what's happening? But the thing is, once you are in Venezuela, and I lived in Caracas for a month, Caracas is one of the most violent cities in the world. Every night, it seems like you are just hearing fireworks because it's just this rain of bullets and gunshots all the time.
From the people you've spoken to, how is the situation in Caracas now?
Most of them, or the people that I talk to, they're really scared. Truth is also the government has provided weapons to the poor people in the favelas, so that when something happens to the government and people go out and do these sort of demonstrations, these poor people from the favelas, they come down and they kill the protesters.
That's Venezuelan expat Leo Rivers speaking to Nicole Johnston. Australia is losing trees at an increasing rate, and researchers believe rising temperatures are to blame. By investigating forest plots, the new study found that while tree growth over 40 years has remained consistent, tree deaths have risen. While planting more trees can help the problem, the paper's author says climate change is the bigger challenge. Kimberly Price reports.
There are a lot of things Yoav Daniel Barnes likes about trees.
Trees focus the mind. They're very big. They're very obvious. They stay put and you can look at them from different angles. And if you had to draw a picture of nature, it often might be a tree.
He's dedicated much of his life to educating others about trees as a forest scientist and guide at Giant Tree Expeditions in Hobart. However, Yoav Daniel Barnes has concerns for the future of trees.
The fires are dramatic, and of course the forest management is something we should all be involved in and talking about. But in terms of heat stroke, we might have a much bigger problem coming barreling right at us.
Research has found Australian trees are dying at a faster rate than previously thought. Belinda Medlin is a professor of ecosystem modelling at Western Sydney University.
We particularly were interested to know whether it was because the forests are perhaps growing faster or if they are younger or older. But we looked at all of those potential causes, and really the best explanation that we found was that it was related to the rise in temperature.
The research pulls together data from forest monitors across the country and tracked more than 2,500 tree plots over several years. The study looked at tree mortality, not losses from clearing, logging or fires. And Professor Medlin found a consistent decline across species.
We looked at tropical savannas, tropical rainforests, temperate forests around Sydney and Brisbane, all the way down to Tasmania, and everything showed the same trend.
If this tree decline continues, Professor Medlin believes it could have far-reaching consequences for the Australian environment.
So if you lose trees, you're looking at a decline in biodiversity, not just of the trees, but of everything else that lives on the trees. If we lose trees, then we lose our ability to sequester carbon. So obviously we need to tackle climate change. If we can slow down climate change, then we can slow down the loss of trees.
She says one way to fight back against tree decline is obvious. Plant more trees.
Kimberly Price there. And that is AM for today. Thanks for your company. I'm David Lipson.